guys, welcome back to the Balancing Bipolar podcast, the podcast that delves deep into the complexities of living with bipolar disorder. So let's have a little chat about what's been going on recently before we delve into the main part of the episode. So in my last episode, I spoke a lot about depression and just how awful it is. It is something that's extremely difficult to deal with. And I have not been using particularly healthy coping mechanisms to get through it, although I am working on that now. And as I am working on it, the depression does seem to be lifting a little bit now that I've got the main stress factors of court and applying for benefits out of the way. I'm just now taking time to recover, focus on myself and my studies, and try and enjoy my life a little bit, because I think one of the things for me, when I get depressed, I will shut myself away. I will not answer any messages. Like, I will just fully isolate myself, which of course is not healthy. It is okay, I guess, for a certain period of time to kind of disappear and get yourself together. But if you're not using that time to actually get yourself together, you really are just, in my experience anyway, like elongating the experience of depression, and it does make it worse. This week has been so much better. It is Thursday now as I'm recording this. No, it's not. It's Friday. It's Friday the 8th of March as I'm recording this, and it's not been too bad of a week. I was actually supposed to record this episode like 3 or 4 days ago, but things just ended up getting in the way, and one of my best friends in the whole world, we're literally identical in our experiences, our traumas, our diagnosis. Like, we are very, very similar in that way, and she's really the only person that I can actually be open with. And we will make light of the situation, but also really help each other. And it's nice to be able to have someone to be open with other than on the podcast. I have expressed many times that I have no one's talked to, and I think during that period of like isolation, I didn't actually want to talk to anyone. But now that I'm starting to feel a little bit better and trying not to isolate myself too much, because I do get very agoraphobic if I isolate myself too much. It literally gives me the worst anxiety ever about going outside. But getting outside and getting out with my friend and having little errands to run and things like that, just an excuse for me to have to get up, get dressed and leave the house, has been so helpful. So now that I'm feeling a little bit better, I am totally ready to start on my little weight loss journey. I've gained 2 or 3 stone since crashing into this depression. When I was manic, I was pacing around the house all the time. If I was at home, I was walking 20, 30,000 steps a day, every single day. I was not eating properly. I was obviously not sleeping properly. So anything that I did eat, the calories were just being burned straight away from the exhaustion that I was putting my body through. And I think now I'm in a place where hopefully I can actually lose the weight healthily. I don't know about anybody else, but for me, weight is one of them things that I have always yo-yoed with. And I have noticed over the years that it has changed with my mood. So if I'm feeling down, I tend to eat more. I come to eat a lot of things that I shouldn't because I don't want to cook. Like, I order a lot of takeaways and things like that. Whereas, obviously, when my mood is higher, I am exercising more, I'm getting out more, I'm eating less because I'm too busy doing other things or thinking about other things, or I'm just totally deluded. Like, any of these situations have always had me yo-yo in weight, and I'm very, very disappointed that I am now at my heaviest. Genetically, in my family, like the women, especially on my mum's side, we do tend to hold on to weight a lot more easily than we lose it, unfortunately. And it does make it very, very hard to lose weight, especially when I've been struggling a little bit with like motivation and things like that. But I figured if the depression is lifting, hopefully my motivation will increase over time. And even just going and doing these little errands, I'm having to go out of my way and walk. And, you know, even just a 10-minute walk a day is better than nothing. So I'm really doing my best with all that. So, with all that personal stuff being said, I'm going to get into the episode and I hope you all enjoy it. So, let's get into it. So, I may have mentioned a tiny little bit about the fact that being diagnosed with bipolar disorder can come with a lot of grief. I grieve for the person that I could have been. I often think, why me? Nobody else in my family has bipolar that I'm aware of. I know I have unfortunately inherited the addiction gene from my dad's side, but I have no idea where the bipolar has come from. And I've tried so hard to articulate how I feel about bipolar in grief, but I've actually found it really hard to put it into words. And thankfully, one of my wonderful Twitter followers and podcast listeners kindly shared with me an essay that she wrote about her experience with bipolar and grief. And she has also kindly permitted me to share this with you guys. And as I read it, I felt like she was perfectly able to encapsulate this experience that I think so many of us go through, and I don't see it talked about enough. So this essay was sent over to me by Danice, and you can find her on Twitter at Danice, that's DANICE underscore Dan. So let's get into reading this essay. Bipolar disorder and grieving. How being diagnosed with a mental illness is as much about the personal grieving process as it is about the psychological, psychiatric, and/or pharmaceutical treatment regimens. It was summer of 2018. My best friend Eugene and I were heading south on Interstate 81. He was driving. It was a beautiful day, no traffic, the sun was shining, the sky was blue, and we had the radio playing. I knew it was important when he turned off the radio and started talking. He lost a woman he loved last year. Marisol's suicide left him battling grief and survivor's guilt. I tried to comfort him, but it didn't seem to help. This was the first time he'd really talked about it. What stunned me was when, after he was finished talking about Marisol, he asked me to make him a promise. He asked me to promise him that I would never kill myself. Without hesitation, I made that promise. But as I said the words, "I promise I will never kill myself," I was choked up, fighting back tears. He's my best friend. I love him, I trust him, and I couldn't imagine attempting suicide again. August 2018 was an important benchmark in my 34-year life. It marked 10 years since I attempted suicide. I've learned so much since then. With the help of my amazing therapist Karen, the treatment team, psychiatrists, psych nurses and behavioural health clinic staff, and my best friend Eugene, I am stable. Bipolar disorder is complicated. It cannot be managed with a single approach. It requires balance. Medication addresses the chemical imbalances. Therapy teaches self-awareness, coping skills and a non-biased perspective. I value the relationships I have in my life, which is why I have a professional, licensed clinical social worker who I see for therapy. Therapy is invaluable. Bipolar disorder to me is like an eternal fight against an invisible enemy. Learning how to identify triggers, how to regain my confidence and trust my own thoughts could have never happened without therapy. The most difficult aspect of being diagnosed bipolar was the grieving process. I could never have understood how diagnosis and grieving were connected. Today, I'm able to look back on the past 10 years and my attempted suicide honestly. The first time I felt in control of my life was when I was diagnosed with bipolar in 2005. It seemed so simple. I had bipolar disorder. It was something I could fix and I was going to get my life back. What I didn't know is that, in fact, I would never have my life back. That having bipolar disorder and being bipolar would be the difference between life and death. There are 5 stages of grief and loss: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. When I was diagnosed, I was in denial. I thought I could compartmentalize having bipolar disorder. I felt in control because I started medication, I educated myself about bipolar disorder, and it wasn't going to ruin my life any longer. It seemed so simple and I desperately wanted it to be, but it wasn't. I didn't know at the time that my life was never going to be the same. I am bipolar, and bipolar disorder is a severe mental illness. It isn't something that goes away. It is something that I deal with every waking moment. Something that has serious consequences if I don't comply with psychiatric treatment, and something that I must put first before anything else in my life. The blissful ignorance of denial was a happy time. My friends and family were supportive. They seemed as relieved as I was. I felt like I'd conquered bipolar disorder. And in fact, I was confident I had. The ugly truth emerged when I couldn't believe the lies I told myself anymore. As denial passed, I had slowly started to realise I hadn't conquered bipolar disorder, but the clear-cut solutions continued to elude me. This is when I became angry. Specifically, I was angry at myself. It was my simple plan that was failing, but I couldn't abandon it because I had nothing else. I became frustrated because, in my mind, I had been doing everything right. It was a flaw, a failure, that metamorphosed into obsession. I was desperate to find the flaw in my plan, to solve the problem, to fix myself. Without a plan, there was no control. No control equaled defeat. The end of my life that I wanted back, which left only the unknown. The longer I obsessed, the greater my doubt that I could hide my failure from the world. This crisis of confidence magnified the stress my interpersonal relationships were under. I didn't want anyone to know I failed. There was nothing they could do to fix the situation, and I couldn't bear to ask for their support. I was disgusted by the idea of announcing that I was having a hard time. Every time they'd ask, I'd tell them I was fine. The shame of admitting that I wasn't, that it was happening again, it was more vulnerability than I could handle. I would rather seem to be fine, even if I wasn't, than to have others doubt me. I was already full of doubt. I felt like I had to apologise all the time for my behaviour, past, present or future. It was like every conversation I'd ever had played back in my mind, highlighting how I'd hurt them or how I'd acted before I was diagnosed. I was racked with guilt about my past behaviour, and I continue to struggle with that guilt today. As years passed, my anger turned to bargaining. I began to believe that I had to accept the stigma about bipolar disorder was true, that I was never going to have my life back. I had to abandon my dreams and ambitions, my high standards, and be satisfied with compromising and compensating for being bipolar. Every time I saw friends or family, I couldn't have a conversation in which I didn't feel I had to justify myself. I was never going to be good enough for my friends and family who knew me before I was diagnosed. I could never erase the past or convince myself that I could prove myself to them. I was under tremendous pressure to keep up appearances. I didn't feel like I could trust myself, my brain, my thoughts, because before I was diagnosed, I honestly believed in every choice I made. I believed I was doing the right thing, and it turned out I was making manic choices. Poor, irresponsible, life-altering decisions litter my past. How could I live with myself doubting my every thought, and why would anyone want to be in my life? The worst moment of my life was when I opened my eyes and I didn't know where I was. I felt terrible, and when I tried to get up, I couldn't. My hands and legs were tied to the bed, and there was a bored nurse sitting against the wall reading a magazine. It took a minute, then I realised that I had survived my suicide attempts. I was alive. No permanent physical or neurological injuries. I felt defeated. My failure made suicide no longer an option. Every time I read a story about a celebrity suicide, like Robin Williams or Kate Spade or Anthony Bourdain, I think about my suicide attempts. They were successful, talented individuals who could afford the best mental health treatment in the world. I think about the differences between us, how yes, mental health illness doesn't discriminate. But why, when they bargained with life, didn't they choose differently? It worries me that there is a copycat connection between celebrity suicide and the number of suicides months afterwards. Since my diagnosis back in 2005 and my attempted suicide in 2008, things started to improve. I started taking lithium. I have been on dozens of different medications, and it took years of patience to find the right combination. I've also learned to be a better patient and advocate for myself. When I was first diagnosed, I wanted to be better so badly, but it took years of cognitive behavioural therapy to develop the self-awareness I have today. Ongoing psychiatric and behavioural health treatment has given me the skills to identify the behavioural aspects of bipolar, as well as to understand and manage my lifestyle to ensure that I can be on the least amount of medication necessary to be stable. I've had to learn how to take care of myself and to make decisions which place my mental health first. I will never break my promise to Eugene. Marisol and I were both bipolar, but we are not the same person. I realised that when I told Eugene that it wasn't his fault, I was basing that wisdom on my personal experience. 10 years ago, I attempted suicide. I made that choice even though I knew I had options. The decision was black and white, no grey area. Today, I am deciding and making choices which are healthier, because therapy has taught me to see beyond absolutes. No matter the circumstance, life is worth living. Educate yourself and strive for balance. So I hope you were all able to take away as much from Danis's essay as I have. I found it super helpful and also very hopeful after reading it. And the way it's written is absolutely fantastic. Coming from someone with a bachelor's in the English language and literature, I thought it was absolutely amazingly written and such a raw and open piece of work. I will pop a link to Danis's Twitter and the essay so you guys can read it for yourself if you would like to. And I would once again like to say a huge thank you to Danis for sharing her experience with us and perfectly putting into words the state of grief, whether we realise it or not, that we go through upon diagnosis and in the months and years that follow. Danis also highlights the importance that therapy has had on her overall well-being and understanding of herself and being able to manage her bipolar in a way that is balanced. Now, unfortunately, where I live in the UK, therapy is actually very inaccessible. There are really no therapy options, and the only thing that people really do get offered is a set of 6 CBT sessions, if anything at all. And I think the difference between the accessibility of support in the US versus the UK is huge. Whilst the US is known for its extortionate healthcare, it also seems to have psychiatric treatment much more available. And I'm not going to go into it too much here, as I am currently doing a lot of research into the accessibility of mental health care in both the UK and the US, as that is where most of my listeners are from. I'd love to hear more from my European listeners on the state of mental health care in their countries too. And I will be dedicating episodes to this, as at the moment, especially in the UK, it is a huge, huge problem. We are seeing huge increases in mental health admissions in children, in adults. Community mental health teams are turning people away in huge numbers, and it's only going to get worse. So I myself have been on a waiting list for almost 2 years just to see a psychiatrist after diagnosis, which may seem unbelievable to some of you, but in the UK it very much is a postcode lottery and differs from county to county. Like where I used to live, mental health care was much more accessible and I was able to get assessments done in like literally like a few weeks. When I moved to the city that I live in now, the healthcare here is completely inaccessible and I have had very, very little support. It's not that the doctors don't want to help, they do, but they are also very limited on the options and the waiting lists can be years and years long. Even for assessments, you could be waiting 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 or 5 years. So it very much is a bit of a mess here at the moment. And counties are kind of like states, I guess, but on a much smaller scale since the UK is pretty small and like counties don't differ in laws and things like that like the states do. But I guess that's kind of what it's like. I would imagine that healthcare differs from state to state in the United States too. So anyway, I know this has actually been a pretty short episode and I've barely contributed anything, but I just, when Danis sent me this essay, it just encapsulated everything that I had wanted to say so much, except without the experience of actually having proper treatment and proper care, which has clearly been a huge, huge benefit in her understanding herself, her thoughts, her diagnosis, how to manage her lifestyle and, you know, remain stable. And I think that's something that's really important and that needs to be accessible. It needs to be there for the people that need it. And unfortunately, at the moment, it isn't. So anyway, I'm going to leave it on that note. I just want to say thank you all for listening to the podcast. I have seen the numbers on the podcast increase drastically over the past few weeks. And I see you all. I see you. And I just want to say a big thank you. Like, thank you so, so much. Like, I actually thought that nobody would listen to this podcast, and to have so many listeners is overwhelming. Like, it's amazing. So thank you all so, so much. And if you want to contribute anything, please email me at balancingbp@gmail.com, or you can find me on Twitter at balancingbp. Thank you all for listening today, guys. And thank you again to Danis for sharing her experience. Everything will be linked in the description. I hope you all have an amazing week. I will be back again soon with more important topics to talk about. So I'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.